Good morning, and welcome to the inaugural CONSOR's Constitution Cast. My name is Julie Silverbrook, and I am the Executive Director of CONSOR, also known as the Constitutional Sources Project, a nonprofit devoted to facilitating greater research and understanding of United States constitutional history. Today's guest is Robert Tsai, a professor of law at the American University Washington College of Law in Washington, D.C. Robert will be discussing with us today his new book, published by Harvard University Press, America's Forgotten Constitutions, Defiant Visions of Power and Community. Welcome, Robert.
Thanks, Julie, for having me.
Our pleasure. My first question for you is about how you came to write a book on America's Forgotten Constitutions.
Well, that's a great question. I was doing some research a few years back on John Brown, and I came across a number of documents that he wrote, a series of editorials explaining some of his actions in resisting slavery. And the more I delved into his behavior, the more I saw a kind of coherent constitutional theory that he had developed that was very unique, but also one that kind of came to fruition in not only editorials, but also in a Declaration of Independence, and finally a provisional constitution he authored a bit before he attacked Harper's Ferry. So that sort of got me thinking and then exploring. And I was really wondering how many other groups of Americans really took it upon themselves to try to recreate the founding moment in their own ways.
Great. So as you know, CONSOR is a digital library. It's a resource for people who want to easily and freely access historical documents related to our nation's constitutional history. We're interested in learning a bit more about the type of historical and archival research you did for this book. How did you unearth information about the formation of these groups' constitutions?
The archival work for this book was both fun and somewhat complicated because I ended up picking to write about 8 episodes, some of which has been written about to some extent. For example, in the middle of my book, I do have a chapter about the Confederate Constitution and the sorts of theories of peoplehood and power that represents. But a lot of the other chapters were about constitutions that smaller groups of Americans wrote. If there was something written about them at all, they might be located in, say, states' archives. So the first chapter involves a constitution that some settlers wrote when they tried to break away from the state of New Hampshire, just sort of after the founding period. Of course, we had to go and scurry up to New Hampshire and dig through their archives. Other archives we looked at included state archives in Oklahoma, since that captures the Constitution written by the 5 civilized Indian tribes. And when that fails, it sort of gets swallowed up in Oklahoma state history. So those are a couple of examples of kind of going to sort of state or regional archives. Beyond the sort of national facilities and resources that we typically look to.
So were you able to find most of the resources in state archives, or were there any private archives that you had to visit as well?
Let's see. There were a few archives that were sort of files that were once, looks like private, but then were at some point given to, say, a university. So the chapter where I think this is chapter 3, I discuss a constitution written by some French socialists that settled mm-hmm. in the Midwest. And a lot of the papers devoted to the Icarians, this is the name of the group, are now located at a university in Illinois. And so that's one example. Another example is there's some private papers of one of the founders of the Republic of New Africa mm-hmm. that I write about in the book. And this is a constitution written by sort of followers of Malcolm X after his assassination. So some of those private documents and interviews and sort of things ended up at Howard University.
Great. So maybe this is related, the question of access to the materials, but how did you settle on the 8 constitutions that you discuss in your book?
Yeah, that was really, really challenging kind of part of the project. And, you know, in a way, there are just so many interesting examples of written constitutionalism in the United States. And what I decided to do ultimately was to try to pick representative constitutions. And by representative, I meant that each of the constitutions reflects, you know, one or more of the sort of models of constitutionalism that I see throughout American history. So, for example, the Constitution written by the settlers up in New Hampshire that wanted their own breakaway republic in Chapter 1 represents a kind of theory of politics and power associated with kind of pioneer sovereignty. And that's a very unique set of ideas. Some would say kind of historically contingent to the need for kind of pushing westward and kind of changing boundaries. But it's also a set of ideas that still exists today. I was just talking to somebody about, I don't know if you've been following this, Julie, but some of these ranchers in Nevada have been fighting against the government. And there's an element to their kind of theory about where their people power to resist the federal government comes from. And in my view, these older ideas of sort of pioneer sovereignty also influence their ideas about law.
Oh, that's really fascinating. I do want to turn to a brief discussion of each of the 8 constitutions you discuss in your book. But before I do that, could you generally discuss the similarities you saw between these later constitutions and the federal constitution drafted in 1787?
Sure. There's sort of a handful of ways in which I sort of collect all these constitutions and consider them kind of reflecting the American constitutional tradition as a whole. First and foremost, each of these groups of Americas, no matter how you know, interesting or wacky their ideas, really accept in a kind of deep and visceral way lesson of the framers, and that is that we all have the power to write a new constitution when things are really going poorly for us. And the other is that they really embrace the fundamental idea that political power resides in the people. Now, where they differ very greatly, actually, is in how to implement these two ideas and what it means to have a community and what it means to actually be able to kind of start all over again. So that's kind of one way in which you know, each of these constitutions reflect the tradition. The other way, and this may be also what you're wondering, is kind of the substance of each of these constitutions have some similarities with our own 1787 American Constitution. For example, it seems like whether you're a socialist or whether you're a Nazi in America, you accept the idea that some notion of divided government is essential, right? That in order to resist tyranny or perhaps to sort of encourage form of specialization, that we really ought to have institutions doing different things rather than having you know, a handful of institutions do everything. So that seems to be one sort of area where everyone agrees. Everybody seems to agree that rights are important, you know, and not only important, but so foundational that we need to write them down in order to kind of ensure that they're safeguarded. So those are kind of two examples of, where, you know, there's sort of broad similarities. From there, there's a lot of very, very strong differences, of course.
Of course. I did find while I was reading the book that it was interesting that these very different groups all seem to agree some form of divided government and some protection of rights were essential. And I thought that was really fascinating that they sort of picked up and stayed with that strain, which is an important part of American constitutionalism.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, they also seem to, and maybe this is not so much the substance, but a sort of broader American attitude that they all seem to share is what some scholars have described as an orientation of perfectionism, right? That that we could always do better, and that somehow, no matter how dire things get, that we can find a way to reinvigorate the law. And writing a new constitution is a sort of the first thing that people often think about as a way of sort of revitalizing our politics.
And of course, the orientation toward writing a constitution is an important theme in the book. They all decide to write a constitutional charter, which I also thought was fascinating.
Yeah, that's right. They do, and so this is also one of the things that became very interesting to me is that when we think of writing a constitution, we typically think of a situation where people have more or less kind of had a clean break from the past, and it's pretty well accepted that they have the authority to write. But in fact, things are a lot messier in reality, and certainly in American politics, they've been quite messy. And we've had instances, in fact, when we've had dueling constitutions, each vying for a kind of legitimacy in the minds of the population. And so, this reality caused me to really want to show that in the book, and to show that even when people had really poor chances, real poor odds of having their constitution approved or accepted by most Americans, that they still found some set of reasons to write a constitution. And those reasons for writing could vary. It could be just sort of identifying that there is a political community that sees itself as separate and distinct. It could be that they want to participate in public debate in a way that they think that having a constitution of their own will help to elevate their voice. Or for some groups, and I'm calling to mind John Brown and some of the black nationalists, having a constitution also meant that they could start to begin to live out the values that they hold most dear. And so even if nobody or most people, most Americans rejected their view of the law, they could start to sort of fulfill their ideals by kind of enforcing those norms within their own communities.
So each of the eight constitutions you discussed in your fascinating book has a really interesting, I think, important backstory. It was a really interesting way to read about American history. And would you mind discussing a little bit about those stories? Obviously, we want to encourage people to go ahead and purchase the book, so don't give away everything, but maybe whet people's appetites with a sense of some of the really interesting narratives that are a part of the drafting of the constitutions.
Sure. We can start with chapter one, and certainly I won't give away the whole story, but chapter one's really, really fascinating because it brings us back to a time when popular sovereignty is really, really much still in the air, and we're still talking about the generation that had kind of gone through the American founding process, so their memories of the arguments and the ideals are I think very vivid. They're also highly educated, at least comparatively speaking, with other countries and their populations at a moment of kind of constitution writing. So, in chapter one, I tell the story of these settlers who kind of squat in an area of contested land. Some people think it's part of New Hampshire, others think it's part of Canada, but in any event, they decide to make it their own home, and they're kind of living there and building it up for a while, but after a while, they feel this sort of deep sense of legal uncertainty. They're not sure whose laws are going to protect them, and at some point, they sort of develop their own political consciousness enough that they decide the best thing to do is to start to write their own laws, and so they start to create their own institutions, and eventually they write their own constitution.
Great. So here's a question that I didn't pose to you beforehand, but I'm curious about. What are some lessons for groups today who might be interested in writing their own constitution? I'm not talking about student groups at a place like the Washington College of Law. Thinking about groups that like, you know, those peeling away from Malcolm X and the African Nation, sort of have a different view of government. They're sort of a separatist group. What lessons can they take away from reading this book?
That's a great question. I think there's sort of some good news and some bad news that can be found in this book. And so if we're students of history and we're interested in how these groups of Americans fared, we can sort of find a kind of template to follow, right? So that we see that in order to be taken at least semi-seriously by other Americans. And we're not only talking about kind of like-minded people who might be attracted to your legal experiment, but also kind of converting other Americans to your cause and then eventually getting kind of more widespread approval. There's a protocol you have to follow. It has to be a kind of deliberative process, and a number of these groups hold a kind of people's convention or a series of popular meetings in order to kind of deliberate and then authorize the writing that they come up with. The writing itself clearly has to respond to the problems that they think are most seriously facing their country. And then at some point, the document has to kind of go out to the world, and this is where it gets really complicated because, the bad news is that if your ambition is to try to displace the national constitutional order, the one that's sort of contemplated in the 1787 Constitution and extended over the years through the courts and so forth, that it's quite a tall task, right? There are lots of reasons why the American Constitution has taken a beating over the years, but has survived. And so it's quite an uphill climb. Now, that's not to say that you can't find spaces within the constitutional order to experiment in kind of law-based ways. And so some of the groups I talk about aren't the armed, separatists that we often think about, but are the more creative types that wrote constitutions or wrote laws that were either specifically blessed by a particular state, and here I'm thinking about the Icarians in the Midwest, or other similar kinds of situations like that, and what these groups are able to do with their own sort of smaller scale constitutions is to envision a whole different kind of world bound by law, and within that world, in some ways they can sort of say, hey, we're not directly challenging the legitimacy of the broader constitutional order, but we are challenging many of the legal and political and even social values. And in that way, I think there's some better signs for groups that want to engage in those kinds of experiments. But by and large, the kind of armed separatist route has not had a very happy outcome in American history.
I think that's right. So tell me a little bit more about the relationship between the Icarian Nation and the state. Obviously, the state constitution supersedes this group's constitution, and then, of course, through the Supremacy Clause, the national constitution supersedes that.
Yeah, this is a really, really a cool episode, right? It's one of actually the more successful alternative legal communities that I talk about in the book. These Icarians are really followers of a French politician named Etienne Cabet, and he really originally envisioned a socialist order in France. But when things sort of don't go his way there, he encourages his followers to immigrate to America, where in the mid 19th century we're experiencing a very open culture to legal and economic and social experimentation. Of course, even as the nation as a whole is trying to consolidate territory in the West and so forth. But Cabet's followers, many of them come to eventually the Midwest. And what they do is they write a social contract among themselves, and this kind of flowers into a constitution, a very complicated constitution that regulates nearly every aspect of their dealings with one another. And as you suggest in your question, another really interesting facet of this experience is they actually get the explicit approval of the state of Illinois to write this constitution.
Robert, what it sounds like I'm getting from you now, what I certainly took away while I was reading the book, is that if you want to experiment in constitutionalism, the cooperative model is the way to go, not the armed separatist route. We are running out of time, so I'm going to leave that as our last thought. Robert, thank you so much for telling us about your fascinating book, America's Forgotten Constitution, Defiant Visions of Power and Community. Now, as I understand it, you are actually going to be posting copies of the constitutions you discuss in your book. Where can our listeners find that?
Yes, Julie. I'm actually kind of reproducing each of the constitutions that are mentioned in the book, all eight of them, on my book blog, and that the address for that is americasforgottenconstitutions.blogspot.com. And so if anybody's interested in reading the actual texts, that's where they can go to find them the easiest.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Robert. Listeners, please go out and purchase Robert's excellent book, America's Forgotten Constitutions, Defiant Visions of Power and Community. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.